Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 95, recorded November 11th, 2010. The fastest GPU this week.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from The Hartford. Discover great rates, benefits, and service specifically designed for AARP members at aarp.thehartford.com/podcast.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, the man, the myth himself. You're looking, oh, come on, pull Ryan back up. Where are you? There he is, Ryan Trout, ladies and gentlemen. PCPer.com, hardware legend.
Hi, Patrick, how are you?
I'm excited. My networking issues have been resolved. My Skype has been reinstalled. My camera is working, and I can actually see you, and you can see me, and John's not in the background going, where did the video go? So this is very exciting for me. So
hey, cross your fingers anytime we can get, as much as we love computers and technology, I guess it's kind of like that law of how many times you try to use something is how often you're going to see these types of hiccups. But I'll tell you what, if every time we had problems with Skype, as often as we have problems with Skype and networks and stuff, if I was trying to get my mom or dad to use it, I might think twice. But they seem to have a lot less trouble than I do. So maybe that's
yeah. But they're also not trying to do it to a standard. There's kind of a difference between having a conversation being like, I am a techno professional and I am creating a video podcast on the internet. Because then the pressure's up, man.
That's true. That is true. That's very true.
So we should probably fire out the big story, NVIDIA GeForce DTX 580, 1.5 gigabytes of memory on that beastie. And you did SLI testing over at PCPer.
Yeah, so this is kind of like the new king of the hill in terms of single GPU performance now. The
fastest GPU ever for six months.
Ever today, right? Probably less than that, let's be honest. this is a GTX 580. They actually look almost identical to the GTX 480, which I also have here as well. They're both large cards. But what's interesting, I guess from a physical standpoint, the new 580 is actually a physically lighter card. It uses a vapor chamber cooler as opposed to a massive heat pipe George Foreman grill style cooler.
Well, what exactly is going on with a vapor chamber cooler? Because I mean, when you think about it, the more traditional coolers on there are essentially using liquid that vaporizes, or at least in theory, to transmit the heat to the outer heat sink and away from the CPU.
That's exactly what it's doing. I mean, it's essentially a rotating system with two wicks that pulls. There's a liquid in there that, as it heats, it vaporizes into gas. That takes the heat away. It spreads it over a larger area. And then as that air cools, it then condenses back down into liquid and it picks up more heat from the GPU and it kind of cycles it. What that allows it to do in this form factor, I don't have this one open, but the heat sink might take up, this whole portion of the graphics card, and it can spread out heat very efficiently, very quickly to all of the fins, the aluminum cooling fins on there. Whereas on the 480, it was really just one huge heat sink with heat pipes kind of taking it to different areas of the heat sink as quickly as it could.
So it's more efficient?
It is. It's more efficient. It's just more expensive. So they were able, basically they said, well, we needed it to keep it at a certain thermal level, TDP level. They just needed to go for the vapor chamber this way. It also allows them to run the fan. If it's more efficient cooling, they can run the fan a little bit lower speed, and they're down, therefore cut down on noise, which is one of the big complaints about the GTX 480 and 470 was that it was hot and it was loud.
Extremely loud.
And the GTX 580 improves on both of those by a pretty good margin. Probably not still as quiet as like the 5000 series of cards from AMD, but much, much quieter than the 480s and 470s.
So how much faster is it?
So a 580 is a new GPU based on the was the GF100, the new GTX 580's GF110. And the difference between there is we went from 480 processing cores on the GTX 480 to 512 processing cores on the GTX 580.
Wow.
They also run a little bit faster clock speed, and the memory runs a little bit faster as well. And there have been a couple of minor architectural shifts, like basically while they were reorganizing transistors and stuff like that, they also tweaked a couple of things that they noticed that they could get done easily and quickly. I'd say overall performance is probably anywhere from 15 to 30% improvement over the 480, going from the 480 to 580. But the kind of one of the keys here is that it's at the same TDP, so that you're going to see a much improved performance per watt, which also kind of translates into performance per decibel, I guess, if you want to make up a new metric as well. I mean, so it's going to be quieter and cooler at the same temperature or the same thermal levels and that kind of thing, and then you get a performance boost on top of it. So this is kind of, a lot of people have said it, and I tend to agree, this is what Fermi, the GTX 400 series of cards, was probably supposed to be. This is what NVIDIA wanted it to be. Because the GTX 480, even though it only has it has 480 cores activated, they're actually, the GPU itself has 512 processing cores. But they had to disable a portion of them in order to reach thermal limits and yield limits, right? So this redesign basically allowed them to get the full performance out of the GPU that they had originally planned to. So, I mean, it's the same 40 nanometer process technology. It's the same 3 billion transistor GPU on there. So, I mean, it's still a beast of a card, right? And it draws almost identical power, but you get better performance out of it. Is it
scaling on SLI like we've seen some of the other cards where we're actually getting like 100% improvement, or is it more the traditional SLI 30, 25, 20, 40% improvement?
So it does really, really well in scaling when it can. And what I mean by that is when you start getting this much performance, you get into CPU-limited scenarios very easily. So Metro 2033, for example, goes from 29 to 52 frames a second. So that's really, really good. We're talking about 80% scaling going from a single card to a dual cards. So that's pretty good. Lost Planet 2, I think we see something very similar to that. We go from 36 to 63. So again, really, really good scaling there. But some of these games, if we look at F1 2010, for example, which is a new racing game, if we look at scaling there, it actually does decent from 50 to 90. Left 4 Dead 2 is one of those games where all of these cards perform so well that it's really doesn't make any sense to have SLI here. I mean, you're going from 120 frames to 190 frames per second on average. I think your 120 is still going to be fine in that regard. Civ 5 is another one that tends to be CPU limited as well. Bad Company 2, I think that one actually scaled pretty well. Yeah, from 47 to 89. So, yeah, I mean, we're still seeing good scaling numbers. It's a matter of what resolution are you playing at that scaling becomes, you know, is it really worth it? I mean, if you're playing on a 19 by 12 display, a single GTX 580 will get you 80 frames a second on Bad Company 2 with all these image quality settings turned up. And that's, you know, that's kind of, 80 frames per second sounds like a lot, but I'd say that's kind of like where you want to be super comfortable that you're not going to drop below 60 very often type of thing. So a pair of them is really 30-inch monitor, and you know, you're planning for the future as well.
But if I'm doing if I'm sitting here with my giant flight simulator powering 9 monitors at full resolution, then suddenly multiple cards start actually saving. Yeah. You're right. Okay, so $500 cards, $1,000 for SLI. The people who are going to buy these cards, you know who you are. 15-30% improvement. I was kind of stoked about the OCZ Revo drive, 240 gigabytes, the PCI Express SSD, but it's really not bringing the price down, or was that just my confusion?
It's not really bringing the price down dramatically compared to other high-end SSDs or other PCI Express SSDs, but it is definitely really, really fast. It's competitive in terms of cost per gigabyte, comparing it to SSDs.
Right.
Compared to the SATA connected.
Yeah, the SATA connector drives, it's competitive. But it's not like going to a PCI Express adapter is going to drop the price per gigabyte compared to an SSD.
It doesn't drop the price. But what is kind of impressive about what OCZ has done with these drives is that it hasn't raised the price either. Because if you look at other competitive PCI Express-based solid-state drives, they tend to be much, much more expensive than your traditional SATA connected PCI right. Express drives, and they are keeping that price down, right? So you can get a 160 gig PCI Express based Revo drive X2 for $569, which is like $3.50 per gigabyte. That's MSRP. We expect to see it a little bit lower than that in the next few weeks or so, but that's expensive, but it's not outside the realm of what other SSDs are going to cost you. But these are much, 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 much faster than your traditional solid-state drive. I mean, we're talking, let's see, where are our burst speeds here? We're talking, 480 megabytes per second burst speed on these, well exceeding what we've been able to see or get out of even SATA 6.0, that type of stuff.
That's pretty fast.
And there's, we're looking at 600 sustained reads and writes at like 600, 700 megs per second.
Wow.
Depending on the application and stuff like that. I mean, these are the benefits you get with a PCI Express-based drive that, are kind of lost when you're trying to push this much data through a SATA cable, unfortunately.
Is it essentially the SATA overhead that's killing performance compared to the PCI Express drives?
I don't know if I would call it overhead. It's not like there's CPU overhead that needs to be processed for it. It's just a data connection that was built for a different style of technology, right? I don't think it was, they have plans for SATA 4 and SATA 5, coming down the pipe. It's just a matter of how quickly are they going to get them implemented, and is there going to be other things that kind of replace it?
I was going to say, it's also amazing looking at the CPU utilization on the HD TAC numbers, like the X2 240 gigabyte Revo drive, is considerably lower than even Intel's X25 or the OCC Vertex drives, which was kind of like, wow. And then what are the IO Extreme drives? Because those are looking like four times as those are kind of like absorbing like four times as much bandwidth compared to the other drives on that test.
Those are like enterprise grade PCI Express SSDs as well.
Okay.
So we're talking really, really, really high. Let's see. The IO Extreme, it was really, really hard to find, and it was $11 per gigabyte.
Okay.
And then the IO Drive 160 was actually coming in at $40 per gigabyte.
Right. So these are still also looking at like 1-3% total CPU utilization, or basically, a chunk of a single core.
Right. Right.
Right.
And these are still expensive. And if you want to get really expensive, actually, OCZ is offering, they have a 960 gigabyte version of this card for sale for about $3,400 or so. $3.50 per gigabyte, so you get the same per gigabyte price. Just a matter of if you really want that almost 1 terabyte of really, really fast solid state drives. For me, that sweet spot is kind of like the 160 gig drive. That's kind of what I'm used to having for an SSD for a bootable partition anyway. About the same price as a good quality 160 gig SSD, but you get much improved latency, much improved bandwidth on those. And I think they're available today. Like, I think I saw them, they were for sale on Newegg as of today. A couple of them were already out of stock. I think maybe the 160 gig was out of stock, but it'll be curious to see how many people actually start to implement these because they just, you just don't think of plugging your storage into a PCI Express slot. It seems still kind of odd. It seems kind of like either future technology or ancient technology, depending on which way you want to think about it.
Right. Well, not that many people actually. I mean, you know, not that many people actually build their own systems. You know, compared to the number of people who buy computers every year, it's still a small percentage that actually upgrade their systems or build their systems from scratch. But I mean, I think it's interesting where you're looking at, you know, something that would have been a kind of a Stone Age technology. I mean, I was buying Excel hard cards back in 1990, like 25, 50 megabyte hard cards to go into ISA slots on computers back then. And,
right.
And it's, you know, other than a couple of experiments using volatile flash RAM or using volatile RAM to create flash drives, there really hasn't been a whole lot of anything that's even remotely affordable for consumers until this last kick on the SSD drives. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to say, I'm a little disappointed. Like, you know, X25M, you know, the 80 gigabyte version is down to $190. Corsair 60 gigabyte for $130. It's not. I was kind of expecting more capacity for less money by the end of this year. You know, people are looking at like double the capacity or half the price. And I guess like. I take that back. I've got a 40 gigabyte XL, or I've got a 40 gigabyte X25N that I paid about $250 for. So, I guess less than $200 for 80 gigabytes would probably be double the capacity. It's just I keep hearing about all these 240, 320 gigabyte cards, and I'm like, I want the bigger flash drive.
I will agree with you that I think price per gig. I feel like it should have decreased more than it has over the last year, especially considering Intel's kind of been, I don't know if they're delaying it or if they're having problems with it. They're 22 nanometer flash-based SSDs. You know, once those are out the door, there's no, you know, excuse other than let's keep these profit margins as high as possible to keep prices, price per gig at where they're at. So,
is OCZ your favorite brand at this point for SSD drives?
They're one of the favorites. I still really like the Intel drives. I'm still a fan of those. I have those in a lot of machines. OCZ is one of the few companies that does more than just regurgitate chipsets. You know, they try to help develop their own firmwares and try to, you know, they have a huge array of different technology options. They're always trying new things, which can be good, can be bad. But for a small company, they're innovating and they're trying to open up these new markets. You know, if OCZ wasn't doing these PCI Express based solid state drives, will we even have access to them at this point? Is a really, I think, a valid question. So,
good to know. All right, we don't talk about Facebook much. Well, I don't think we've ever actually talked about Facebook. I'm pretty sure we haven't, but it's kind of interesting. If you've never checked it out, there's a website called datacenterknowledge.com, which talks about giant data centers, these big facilities that people like Facebook and Google create. And it's kind of interesting. I thought if you're kind of curious about serious hardware installations, Facebook just built one in Oregon. They're now building one in North Carolina. They're going to spend about $450 million, about 150 acres. Wow. And they're going to build a 300,000 square foot a 300 square foot data center about the size of your bathroom, a 300,000 square foot data center. It's going to take 18 months to build. And what's crazy is when you realize there's going to be thousands of machines inside this building, it's only going to take about 40 full-time and part-time contract workers to run it. But the thing I thought was really interesting is looking at the cooling that they're playing around with, because one of the biggest expenses on data center after electricity is cooling, because these systems, all of these systems howling away inside a data center generate a huge amount of heat. And Facebook's been playing around with, in their Prineville, Oregon data center, they've been using evaporative cooling instead of a chiller system, which reduces the amount of electricity it uses. That's one of the big movements in these giant data centers. And then recycling the heat from the servers to heat the facility in the winter. But I also thought it was really interesting. It's like the Prineville design foregoes, and this is a quote from the article, traditional uninterruptible power supplies and power distribution units, and adds a 12-volt battery to each server power supply. So basically, they're hot wiring in a 12-volt battery. And it's kind of funny, like Google did a huge article talking about consumer drive reliability, because it turns out Google is scaling on such a ridiculous level and building so many server boxes and so many data centers, it was just fiscally ridiculous to use, you know, enterprise or RAID style hard drives. They use consumer grade hard drives, which led them to write some interesting papers on the failure rates on consumer hard drives and how it relates to smart data. So if you want to get your nerd on, I highly recommend checking that one out. And then the AMD APU Zikate, you're going to have that in at PC Per next week, Ryan?
Yeah, if we have a little bit of a preview at PCPro.com this week, but it's more kind of an architectural overview. We weren't allowed to post numbers, but AMD had me down in Austin last week, actually last Wednesday, and I got some hands-on time with the first released AMD APU, which is the accelerated processing unit, the CPU GPU combination part. And by this time next week, we'll have had an article posted that looks at performance and power consumption of it compared to the newest Atom processors, Intel CULV, things in that type of netbook, low-cost notebook realm. And I think the numbers are going to be pretty impressive. We'll talk about that next week as well. Cool. But I want to give you guys a little bit of a heads up to start thinking low power as well, not just this. I mean, I think, let's see, for an example, you can get 10 complete systems running on this APU, on these AMD APUs, for the power draw you get out of this graphics card.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
As I was pointing out, we finally got our boxy box in here. Our first one actually disappeared to Monaco, and I won't talk about that, but we'll have a full review of the boxy box, which turns out to be a Intel Atom-powered machine. We talked about Tegra losing the boxy box earlier this year, but we'll talk about the implementation on this and how it works with 1080p video next week on Texilla NHD Nation and the unbelievably bizarre case that comes in.
It's very cool. I'm still a fan of that. Before we get into emails,
it's
take
growing
a quick
on
second.
Me a lot.
I think it's just unique enough. It's not really convenient for putting in a shelf somewhere, but yeah, we can go for that next week too. But before we get into our emails for the week, wanted to go ahead and thank this week's sponsor of This Week in Computer Hardware, AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford. For our audience members over the age of 50, the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford can save you as much as $384 on auto insurance. More than 3 million AARP members who are already enjoying the benefits of this program. Benefits that include lifetime renewability, lifetime repair guarantee, and a 6-point claim guarantee. Current customers describe the claims experience as, quote, fast, easy, and outstanding. When's the last time you've heard that from car insurance companies? Check them out today and get an 8-minute quote. Go to aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. That's aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. We say we jump into a couple of emails we got here this week.
I am totally ready for emails. Dr. Jim Beam has a question about wireless audio. No whiskey humor allowed at this moment. He says, I got a boring question for you. I'll understand if you ignore it. I'm looking for a way. There are no boring questions, just boring answers. Looking for a way to wirelessly stream analog stereo music from one device to another. Distance is about 12 feet. Any suggestions? Trying to get music channels from my cable box to my little bookshelf stereo system. Looking for something cheap and simple and cheap, like less than $50 if possible. Less than $50 is tough, right? Because so many of the devices that are available today are either Bluetooth based, which sounds like ass, and I highly recommend you avoid Bluetooth stereo audio. Or more importantly, almost all of them are either USB audio based or designed to plug an iPod into. EOS Convergence does a pretty good. EOSWireless.com is the website, but their Converge is $100 for the transmitter and $100 for the receiver, which is four times what Dr. Jim Beam wants to spend. Something a little closer to his range is Rocketfish does, which is a house brand for Best Buy, does the universal wireless rear speaker kit. It's $110. I've seen them for sale used on eBay and the Yahoo Marketplace for as little as $60, or maybe refurbished. And it does CD quality audio, which I think is fine if you're going from cable audio isn't the best, to a boombox. Basically CD quality audio on the open 2.4 gigahertz range. The only downside is if you turn off the source before you turn off your receiver, you're probably going to hear a buzz or sort of an annoying kind of hum or buzz on the channel, because some people are saying it's pretty noisy if it doesn't have an input source. But you know, I'd be curious. There's lots of devices designed to do USB wireless audio from a computer or a notebook, but actually taking an analog source and spitting an analog source out, analog input, analog output is a little more difficult. But I'm going to say the Rocketfish universal wireless speaker kit is probably going to be one of the easiest ones to find. Because that's the other problem, is a lot of stuff was out there a few years ago, but it's very difficult to actually find one for sale. In a lot of cases, they were doing some unbelievably nasty front-side compression of the audio before sending it to the receiver, and you end up with this horrendous audio quality situation.
Yeah, nobody wants that. That's a good idea, though. Getting anything for that close to that price is going to be tough. $110, not too bad.
It's you know, I mean, but the problem is 12 feet, like, boy, you know, can you run a wire under the cable or under the carpet? Not cable. Can you run a cable under the carpet? Because 12 feet is like
it's so close.
So close and yet so far.
It's always the last 12 feet.
You talk to Malventano, who's the storage editor for PC Perspective. We had a user commenting on that basically the world was going to disintegrate if people used Western Digital green drives or black drives and servers, because Western Digital themselves says only their RAID drives can be used for NAS boxes and everything's going to fall apart. And I read that viewer response with great trepidation. But Western Digital does say, TLER, the time limit error recovery, basically, they would give you, you could download a tool, turn it on, and for primarily hardware RAID controllers, it would prevent the hard drive from going into deep recovery mode, which would oftentimes have the controller thinking that the hard drive had died, and then the RAID would basically break. Mm-hmm. Similar technologies are error recovery control on Seagate, the command completion time limit, which is the name that Samsung and Hitachi uses. And I got to be honest with you right now, I'm kind of irritated with Western Digital deciding to charge you considerably more for a RAID quality hard drive and disabling or basically disabling your ability to turn this on. The truth is that it doesn't really matter that much, because hardware controllers are the ones that are primarily affected by TLER, especially the cheap-ass 0 and 1 RAID controllers on motherboards, compared to software systems such as FreeNAS, especially running ZFS. Can you tell I spent a lot of time researching this week?
Yes.
FreeNAS, Unraid, and some of it, especially like FreeNAS with like ZFS and stuff, where they kind of take over the situation. So you talked to Alan, and he said he ran an 8 drive RAID 5 of 1 terabyte Caviar Greens for 3 months, a 10 drive RAID 6 of 1 terabyte Caviar Greens for 3+ months, a 6 drive RAID 5 of 2 terabyte Caviar Greens for 1 month. And, you know, because basically they turned off the ability to turn off user control of TLER back in October 2009. And he says he has not had a single dropout of any of these. He also points out that Drobo packages are units with Caviar Greens, not RE4s, as do nearly all of the NAS manufacturers. I can't think of a consumer NAS manufacturer using RE4s, actually. So
for his configurations there, I'm pretty sure he's using an Arika RAID card, which is a fairly high-end...
Nice.
Hardware RAID card, so that, you know, that comes into effect. He says that he attributes most dropouts to cheesy RAID cards, so, you know, those promised chips that's integrated on motherboards and those types of things, just like you said, and or flaky SATA cables. Apparently this is a problem that not a lot of people think of, that SATA cables that come loose, that feel like they're in but might not be, or they're not making a connection enough.
Right.
I've replaced cables on them and fixed problems, which is one of those things that you just, usually with like digital cables, you just think it's plugged in, it's working. No worries about that.
SATA plus hot glue gun equals stable connection, by the way. Just make sure you don't get hot glue down in between the copper pins on the SATA connector on your board and the SATA cable itself.
Right. I guess TLER. I don't think we'll say that it's over for now, but that should be good for those of you that are really, really worried about using Caviar Greens. Maybe don't be as worried as we might have let you feel a couple of weeks ago. So, we got an email here from Cameron about hybrid hard drives and setting up partitions. He says, "Hey guys, love the show. Have a question about setting up partitions on a hybrid solid, a hybrid SSD or HHD like the Seagate Momentus XT. What I want to do is set up a very light Linux partition just in the 4 gig SSD drive to allow for ultra quick booting. Then set up the main hard drive for standard Windows 7 install. Is this possible to do? If so, how can I go about doing it? If not, could you recommend a budget friendly laptop SSD?
I thought the whole point. Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, since I thought the whole point of the hybrid disk drive was that you had system memory kind of acting like a, or the memory on the hard drive was acting like a giant cache. It wasn't a separate drive from the hard drive. Am
you
I
are
wrong
correct.
About that one? Okay.
I
love the idea.
Therefore, what you're
Cameron,
trying to do is not possible. So you don't get to access the 4 gigs of flash memory on there as if it were storage. It's basically, instead of having a 32 meg cache on a hard drive, now you have a 4 gigabyte cache. And the benefits that provides are sometimes substantial on frequently accessed files, your operating system files, your application files. You know, those things are stored there, not permanently. It's just like acting like a cache, anything else. But if they are there, then you get the speed up of SSD performance or near SSD performance. But if it's not there, it goes and reads it from the regular drive, copies it to the flash as it reads it out to you. So what you're trying to do, not possible. It shows up as just one drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, you know, part. And even if you decide, I'm going to partition the first 4 gigabytes, that's not how it's going to work for you.
Right.
As for budget-friendly laptop SSDs, I mean, really go to Newegg or go to Amazon and look for, OCZ or Corsair. Those brands tend to have lower-cost IndieLinks controllers that you can get, 100 gigabyte, 80 gigabyte SSDs for pretty cheap, 160, that something like that. And there's a whole host of it. You go to pcper.com/SSD, you can get like a, what do we call it? An SSD, Rolodex or decoder ring, where it kind of details all the different drive manufacturers and what controllers they use and all that kind of stuff. You can get a little bit more detail there.
Nice. Sorry, I was checking the pricing on something for an email from Horse about switch options. He says, I'm planning out my home network. I want it to be gigabit with future-proofing. Excellent. As such, I am going to be running Cat6 cable, also excellent. Says, I plans on 2 ports in each room, which may be overkill, but I still like it. So around 18 to 24 ports total. What switch would you recommend buying to handle this? I hear all kinds of things like buy one with no plastic, make sure it has fans. But outside of that, information seems pretty poor for the home networker if the device isn't integrated into a popular wireless router, which usually maxes out at 4 ports. Heck, does an 18 to 24 port switch with a wireless AP even exist for a home network? Okay, first of all, the nice thing about a switch, right, is a hub is a bunch of dumb Ethernet ports, and anything that hits one of the hubs basically gets bounced to all of the hubs. A switch does intelligent switching of packets, so it doesn't send it to all of the packets. It just keeps you from ending up with giant packet storms on every node of the network every time you send a piece of information or make a request from a server or you're transferring a video. It basically reduces network congestion. This is all good. The nice thing about switches is you can plug a switch into a switch, unless I've got this horribly wrong, in which case we'll get a bunch of emails from system engineers, from sysadmins next week. But basically, you can take your, you can take the gigabit router and plug your gigabit switch into it, and it will handle all the switching from hither and yon. I would suggest, unless you actually need 24 ports, you might want to get a smaller router. Before I say that, though, I will send you to smallnetworkbuilder.com, which is, in my opinion, doing the best. Whoops, smallnetbuilder.com. It's kind of funny. I'm on this site like every other week, and I still think of it as network and not net. Smallnetbuilder.com, which is a pretty amazing website for consumer and small business networking. They are one of the last places doing really extensive testing of wireless routers. They do NAS boxes. They talk about security. They've got some amazing how-to guides if you're setting up a network. I really can't recommend it strongly enough. I'm a big fan of Netgear's switches. and they've got some pretty reasonably priced ones. You're not going to find a 24-port, you know, gigabit Ethernet switch with a router built into it. You're basically going to plug your router into the gigabit switch or vice versa.
Yeah, and in fact, I think it makes sense to not do that, not even try to look for it. Separate your router from the switch. That way, if you want to upgrade routers to 802.11, whatever, you're not looking at it as much of an expense. I mean, you can get a Netgear 24-port gigabit rack-mountable switch for $190 to $200, which seems pretty reasonable to me for something that's going to be that fast.
Yeah, the issue with plastic versus steel, I don't really I think it's a non-issue because I've seen a lot of plastic in some pretty expensive server racks. Your bigger issue is whether or not is basically keeping an eye. If you stuff everything in a closet and you have a server in that closet, the amount of heat coming off of the server, depending on the CPU you're using, you can basically create your very own personal easy bake oven out of a closet in your home if you stuff two computers in there. I don't think a lot of the switches will be affected, but you may find yourself needing to do things like creating ventilation or adding a fan into that room that pulls cool air from outside of the room or at least sucks the hot air out of the top of that closet out into the rest of the house. If it's in the basement, it's less of an issue. There's lots of free airflow. One of the things I'm actually thinking about dropping into my home network is Netgear does their ProSafe routers, or I should say their ProSafe switches, which integrate VPN, which means I could do a VPN login to my home network from anywhere I am and basically have a secure connection so I don't have to worry about people trying to grab my information while I'm on a relatively public Wi-Fi device. Right. But I'm a pretty big fan of the Netgear stuff right now, especially if you're thinking about buying an 802.11n router, their WNDR 3700. Everybody who has bought one of those is super happy with it. The performance is solid, and the radios are working pretty well on those too.
What did you call it? Was it the WNDR 3700? I think that's exactly the one I have. Does that also have like USB storage support on there as well? I think it does.
I think so.
The RangeMax dual band, yeah. Yeah. So there's at least one model that has a USB port that you can plug an external hard drive into and make it a network drive. So not quite a Drobo or NAS or anything like that, but still pretty good. So.
It's a nice convenient way to do some backup. So But yeah, ProSafes are pretty good. The Netgear boxes are pretty good. And the truth is switches are the new hubs, and switches
usually
and hubs.
They even still sell hubs, honestly.
It's getting really hard to find a hub, but part of the reason I brought that up is that it's kind of Stone Age technology. It's cheap. Everybody understands how it works, and unless there's somebody out there with miserable performance that I haven't heard of, you're probably not going to be too unhappy with any brand of switch you get. Cue video from Horse in a few weeks telling me he bought the brand X switch and it destroyed his life. So
nah, couldn't possibly. let's see. We've got two emails here kind of in a row on a similar subject. First one comes from Mike about Crossfire and single GPU upgrades. He says, I was wondering if I should upgrade to a new AMD 6870 from my Crossfire ATI 5770s. Is it worth it to upgrade? Are there any better AMD cards coming out soon? Would it be a noticeable upgrade? Also, I wrote in last time about Crossfire X not making much difference in some games and found out it wasn't supported in some titles like World of Warcraft or StarCraft. Does this mean it only uses the power of one GPU? You'll find that in some cases, GPUs or games won't scale well with Crossfire or SLI. Crossfire in general tends to scale less effectively than SLI does just in the past year or so. And some games like StarCraft that are CPU-bound, World of Warcraft, another game that tends to be CPU-bound, adding another GPU isn't going to make a big difference. That's not necessarily ATI's fault or AMD or NVIDIA's fault. That's just kind of the way the dice fall in terms of what the developers focused on in terms of performance and graphics and that type of stuff. Specifically, going from a 6870 to 5770s, I would say a 6870 is going to be of similar performance level to a pair of 5770s, but then you're not going to have the headaches of multi-GPU compatibility. You're always going to get the thing I've always said about multi-GPUs versus single GPU. With, for example, the GTX 580 is performs actually a little bit slower than a pair of GTX 460s and SLI, which is an interesting kind of thing that we found in our testing this week with the GTX 480. And it's they're $60 or $70 less expensive for the pair of GTX 460s. So that's noticeable, but you're always going to get all the performance out of a single GPU. You don't have to wait for software updates. You don't have to wait for profile changes. You don't have to wait for new drivers to come out to take advantage of the performance. I mean, you still might get performance improvements in a driver with a single GPU, but there have been cases where, like F1 2010, for example, is a game that performance didn't scale at all on SLI or Crossfire when it first came out. A new driver came out within, 30 days or something like that. It's 30, 60 days. And now we do have scaling from it. But with a single GPU, you don't have a lot of those same types of headaches. So that's kind of, it always depends on your budget too. If you're going with a single 460 for $200 today with the plan of upgrading $200, and you don't want to, save up all that money and spend all $400 or $450 at one time on a higher end card, that's a different argument. So that's why I would say, in general, I tend to lean towards the single GPU option.
Good to hear. So does that bring us to Mike D's question?
Yeah.
With his Alienware Aurora ALX i7-950 with an AMD 5970 and a single display, he wants to upgrade to an iFinity with three displays. Would he benefit more from a second 5970 or holding out for the 6000 series dual GPU card that will eventually be out? I know I'm asking for a bit of speculation given that the newer card isn't out yet. Just not so confident on how well Crossfire scales to four GPUs. I realize I'll need to upgrade the PSU that is already in the budget.
So, yeah, if you take what I said about going from one to two GPUs, going from one to four, or actually two to four in this case, because the Radeon 5970 is already a dual GPU card. It's Crossfire on a single card. Mm-hmm. The 5970 by itself is still a great, great graphics card. It's actually faster than the GTX 580. There's not a whole lot of cases where I can think of where this guy would need to upgrade his graphics card for anything. However, if he feels like he needs to, I don't think adding another 5970 is going to be the best option, because going from two to four, the law of diminishing returns is going to come into play here, where, going from one to two, we saw some performance improvements, hence why the 5970 is a great card. Going in and adding a third or a fourth, you're not going to see near as much performance scaling as you did by going from one to two. So if I were him, I would say I would wait. I would wait to see what the 6900 cards are going to come out with. If he goes to the website and reads about the 580, mm-hmm. He'll know what he's going to get there. And he could get one 580 today. It's going to be about the same performance, maybe even a little bit less, but then he has the option to upgrade to two GPUs there. So then you're going to get more scaling going from one to two than from two to four. It's kind of a complicated answer. I would say at this point you should probably just be waiting and seeing what happens before the end of the year.
Yeah. So on a less speculative note, we've got Jan, who's looking for silent gaming PC options. He says, I had a discussion with a friend yesterday about his plans to buy a new box. And this is something I notice that happens a lot with serious gamers. You want something silent, very silent, but of course capable of running an up-to-date shooter at 19x12. This is all very reasonable. And here's where the classic gamer moment is. Now, we found a company that sells such machines, silent, high-speed gaming machines. Jan was a bit suspicious, though, because the 1,500-pound machine, or excuse me, Euro machine, which is what, like 3,000 US, did not even have a solid-state drive. In a test, I read how they ran the GPU fan. It was a constant speed, causing the thing to run at the boiling point, throttling the GPU. So much for that. By the way, they had a 10,000 RPM drive in there, which is neither thermally efficient nor particularly quiet, even if you wrap it in a drive enclosure. Now, Jan's question, do you have a recommendation for brands or series of silent graphics cards with enough oomph to run modern games? It doesn't have to be passively cooled model necessarily. I think the rest, like CPU heat sinks and power adapters, is doable, but I don't know any serious graphics adapters that are silent. And I promise if you find harsh words, I will make him listen. No harsh words. No harsh words. But yeah, it's the GPU is hard. I mean, there are a lot of you know, sort of big, slow-moving fans on gigantic coolers that are pretty, like, 20 dB range for CPUs. Silent power supplies are actually getting almost common. There's some better case designs doing smart things, like putting all the heat so it flows up through the case. I'd almost rather build one than buy one, but... What's going to be a fast, relatively quiet card? Are the new 5800s going to do that with the new cooling devices on there, Ryan?
That's really tough. So, I mean, I could make some recommendations of what would be quieter than most cards, but to go anywhere close to saying silent or near silent, right, especially while gaming, none of the cards today that use that have standard fans on them are really built for that. The only thing is to look at water cooling at that point, right?
That's true.
You can get, high. If we're talking about high-end graphics cards here, you know, mid to high-end graphics cards, look at EVGA sells cards already built with water blocks, or you can, if you already have one of their cards, you can buy EVGA-branded water graphics cards. You can get MSI sells a GTX 480. Hydrogen GeForce is the name of it, that has a really nice water block built onto it. It's a $600 graphics card still. You're not going to find passively cooled cards that are going to be at the 5700 or 460 level of performance or above. It's just not going to happen right now.
One of the things that is worth pointing out is these cards don't have to have the giant, sounds like a jet engine, fans running unless you're playing video games that are really taxing the GPU. You know, if you're, right, if you're browsing the web, if you're, you know, screwing around, you know, writing up homework, you know, running an Excel spreadsheet, you can set it up so that the fans throttle down in these, or you can manually turn the fan down, or you run a water cooling system that's going to be relatively unnoticeable compared to a fan running at full power. Because a lot of people are like, oh my God, this machine is so loud. But the reality is it only has to be loud when you're actually taxing the CPU and the GPU. It'll still generate a lot of heat. It'll just do it a lot quietly. So
it'll release that heat into your room very quietly. I'm just looking at Newegg. The highest performing card that's not $600 that is passively cooled is a Power Color Radeon HD 5750, which is a decent mid-range card. But you know, if this guy is considered a hard end, a high end gamer, a hardcore gamer that you know is looking at SSDs and all that kind of stuff, I'm not sure 5750 is going to be fast enough. I mean, he could do two of them in Crossfire, and those are still passive and all that kind of stuff. But it looks like if he wants really silent, you just start looking at water cooling options.
I like water cooling. FrozenCPU.com, even if you want to buy for a UK site, FrozenCPU.com is a great site to see what's available in terms of water cooling devices, quieter CPU fans and stuff. Just one of my favorite places to shop for that stuff. Because I buy almost everything else from Newegg.
Sometimes it's nice to mix things up, right?
David writes in, following up on the rheumatoid arthritis computing question. Hey guys, I'm writing in regards to last week's episode, Twitch 94, and the listener's question about the best netbook for her mother. My own mother has been suffering from severe rheumatoid arthritis for over two decades now and has moderate deformation in her hands. Many everyday tasks have become impossible for her to perform. She's been using a Sony Vaio for most of her computing tasks for the past few years, but has been doing more and more on her iPhone in the past year. I recently purchased an iPad for her to try out, and she loves it. It is much easier for her to navigate via the touch interface, and she now does almost all of her computing on the tablet. It is also easier for her to access content via the App Store. The two biggest drawbacks to her are the lack of a print feature. That's going to be fixed, and there's a hack for that. And weight. It is a little heavy for her to use in certain positions, but it is lighter and more ergonomic for her than my HP Mini Note. Thanks for the great show. David. David, that is exactly the kind of information we were looking for. Thank you so much for sending that one in there. So
it turns out the iPad might be good for that kind of stuff. You said they're fixing printing. Is that coming in an update, or is it only the hack you're talking about?
Well, there's a 4.2, I believe, is actually going to implement some printing features for the iPad.
Do we ever get 4.0 on the iPad yet?
No comment. But yeah, basically multitasking, printing, and some other stuff are coming in iOS 4.2. Basically, 4.2 is going to be pushed out on all devices. You know, I if I could figure out how Apple does their operating system upgrade numbers, I'd probably be making a lot more money than I do.
Oh, absolutely.
You have the ECS contest winners.
Do you have the ECS contest winners? The winner of an ECS Black Series A890 GXM motherboard. This is an AMD AM3 socket ready motherboard. It's got 890 GX integrated graphics, ready for Phenom 2, X4, X6 processors, all that goodness. The winner goes to Rob Maxwell. His response, we are asking for what their upcoming hardware upgrades were going to be. By the way, the winner was just picked randomly through a number generator, and then we just decided to read their submission. He said, "I love the show. Only found it around episode 66, but you guys have inspired me to build my first computer, replacing my current socket 939 machine. I guess this keeps in vogue with your spate of old computer upgrade shows. I do a lot of minor tech work for friends and family, but I've never built one from the case up." He wants to know if we can recommend a graphics card in the ATI for $200 or so. Wants to connect two monitors and also an HDTV for home theater use. Not much of a gamer, but would like to be able to game and do some Photoshop. Looks like he wants three displays, two monitors and an HDTV that falls perfectly into the AMD iFinity 3 graphics cards hooked up to your system. You know, if you're not doing a much gaming, you know, get a Radeon 6850, right? I mean, those cards are gonna be $170, $160 probably. You can connect three displays to them, but one caveat is you have to make sure you get if you've got existing monitors, I'm going to assume they're not DisplayPort monitors, so you have to have one DisplayPort to DVI adapter. If you look at some of the cards like Sapphire, I believe maybe XFX, they will come with these adapters in the box, so you'll be able to hook up three displays to your graphics card right out of the box without a problem. And that's well under $200. So I think that would be a good choice. Get all three of those displays working at one time and should not have any problems.
Nice. I think it's going to wrap this edition of This Week in Computer Hardware. Do us a favor, email us your questions, your comments, your suggestions, Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. You can find us both on Twitter, twitter.com/PatrickNorton for me, twitter.com/RyanShrout for Mr. Shrout, who is the founder and leader of PCPer.com. What's coming up? I mean, Outside of the AMD stuff, what's coming up on PCPer next week?
So we've got some more storage goodies coming up. Do you like the idea of having a solid-state drive in the size of a DIMM module that actually plugs into a DIMM slot on the motherboard to draw power? We've got something very, very interesting like that coming up. We've got, like we mentioned before, the upcoming APU testing will be up next week. And then I don't know exactly when we'll have the future AMD graphics cards and all that kind of stuff. That might be next month, but we've got, there's tons of stuff coming down the pipe here, so keep checking back.
Nice.
And where can we find you? HD Nation, of course, hdnation.tv and techzilla.com or vision3.com/techzilla. See, I'm remembering these URLs now.
Awesome. TKZILLA.com. You can tell that the Techzilla started a long time after PC Per. Our URL is a lot longer and it's spelled weird. Boxy Box review coming up next week. We thought we were going to have it in this week's show, but we didn't get our hands on a box in time. And for HD Nation, I'm actually doing, if the screen shows up, and I should probably go run down to Fry's and buy one just in case, I'm going to be installing a projector, basically talking about what you need to do to install a projector, a front projector in your home, because part of me, like, I'm in love with the Samsung 8000. It's one of the most beautiful HDTVs I've ever seen. I think it's actually a better TV than their 9000. But I'm going to try to go for the gigantic 80-inch screen in the house and see whether or not that overwhelms the living room and terrifies my neighbors.
So. I want to see pictures. We got to see some pictures of that.
So we record live every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. My name is Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Twitch.